The theme of this retreat has been titled The Three Characteristics, sometimes called The Three Characteristics of Existence. And this comes from the classic Buddhist teaching about the nature of reality, specifically the nature of conditioned reality. The Buddha, in his teachings, talked about conditioned reality and unconditioned reality. In today's vernacular, we might call it the absolute and the relative realities. The conditioned reality being the reality of time and space and form and circumstances. It's the relative world. It's referred to as the conditioned reality because everything in this world arises based upon certain conditions. Everything is conditioned upon something else happening, something else existing. If it rains or it snows, it's because certain conditions exist. If we're born at a certain time, it's because certain conditions exist. If we die at a certain time, it's because certain conditions exist. The fact that our body is alive is based upon certain conditions. If any of those conditions change, then the effect will change as well. So everything in the conditioned world is dependent, and it is not an absolute reality, but simply a relative reality. One metaphor might be that of looking in a mirror. If we look in a mirror, we see something. We see something that appears to be real. And in a sense, it is real. There is a real image there. But it's a secondary reality. It's a conditioned reality. If I look in the mirror and I see my face is really in that mirror, but it's there only because I'm standing in front of the mirror. It's a reality that's conditioned upon my presence. Should I get away from the mirror, my image would no longer appear on the mirror. And so it is with everything in this world of time and space, the conditioned phenomena. It is dependent. In this particular reality that we live in case you missed it, this reality of time and space, it's where we camp out for a long time, for 60, 70, 80 years or more. And it's for the most of us, it's the only world that we know. And it's the world in which we become entangled. And we'll talk about how we become entangled in that world. And that world has three essential characteristics that the Buddha said if we saw deeply into the nature of any one of these, we would be free. We would be free of that entanglement. We'd be free of the bondage to this conditioned reality. And those three characteristics in the traditional Pali language, Pali being the language of the Buddha, the three characteristics are dukkha, anicca, and anatta. And roughly translated into English, very roughly in some cases, it translates into suffering, impermanence, and no self. And all three of those are relatively misleading, but it's the best English words that can be found. So we'll look at those. We'll unpack each of them. Today we'll talk about the characteristic of dukkha. And then tomorrow we'll talk about anicca and anatta. And we begin with the characteristic of dukkha because this particular notion of dukkha, or sometimes called suffering, is embedded in the Four Noble Truths, the cornerstone of the Buddhist teaching. everything that is taught in any form of Buddhism is based upon the foundation of the Four Noble Truths, as they've been called. And it begins with the phrase that you may have heard many times, that sometimes written life is suffering. The word that was used, of course, is dukkha. And suffering is really only one of many words that could be selected to be equivalent to dukkha. In fact, it's probably not the best word. The best word might be unsatisfying. To say that conditioned reality is unsatisfying is to recognize that there's nothing in this conditioned realm, the realm of time or space or form, nothing in the physical or mental or emotional realm that is capable of permanently satisfying us. That's what the principle of dukkha is saying. This world of time, space, and form can give us pleasure, and it can give us perhaps momentary satisfaction. It's fleeting, in case you haven't noticed, but sometimes we can have periods where we feel completely, totally satisfied. But then before long, something else arises that's problematic, and that satisfaction tends to wear off rather quickly. And so, as we're conditioned, we look for something else. It was greatly educational to me, as it is every Christmas, to watch my grandkids open their Christmas gifts. And to see them go from one gift to another gift to another gift to another gift until they're literally buried in gifts. And yet none of those is quite good enough. One of them may capture their attention for a while, but the batteries die out, or one of the parts gets lost, or something gets broken, or before long, dukkha sets in. And there's dissatisfaction. And I can remember my one granddaughter crying because something, what was it? We didn't have the right size batteries for one of her presents. And so here she is surrounded by mountains of presents. And she's crying her eyes out because the batteries, there's no batteries for this one thing that she wants, you see. And that's a classic example of dukkha. We all do it in our own way, you see. It isn't just children. So the Buddha recognized that the dukkha is endemic in the human condition. In fact, we might say it is the human condition. When philosophers talk about the human condition, or theologians talk about the human condition, typically they're referring to the condition that seems to be inherent in all human beings, no matter what, of this sense inside of ourselves that we're not fully satisfied. And when we're young, we believe this satisfaction can be filled with something or somebody. And so we, as we are conditioned to do, we go in search of the right job, the right mate, the right title, the right degree, getting, owning, identifying with, maybe getting enough of something. But as you well know, there isn't the right thing or the right person or enough of anything that can make us happy for very long. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the world or the people or things in it. The world is wonderful. People are wonderful. But none of it is capable of making us happy, of giving us satisfaction. And therein lies the rub, because we're deeply conditioned to look to this world for that experience of satisfaction. And we don't find it. And in not finding it, we typically look for something else, or we look for more of the same thing. And we become perhaps addicted to someone or something. There's a deep-seated belief, perhaps, that if we get enough of something, or get it often enough, or if we can hold on to it, possess it, that it's going to give us what it is that we're really looking for. So the principle of dukkha is recognizing that there is nothing that can do that for us. Now, to some people, that may be a downer. But to me, it's very freeing, because I can get off of that treadmill. I can stop looking for something that's not there. And I find when I stop looking to someone or something to make me happy, then I can appreciate what's here, who's here. I can appreciate what's in my life, because I'm not trying to make it do something that it's not designed to do. But we get into all sorts of troubles when we try to get blood out of a turnip, so to speak, when we try to get something out of the world that it just can't give. And that creates relationship problems, it creates health problems, it creates all sorts of problems in human life. So what is it that keeps us looking? What is it that keeps us looking to this phenomenal world, this conditioned reality for satisfaction? Even if we know, which many of us have known long time ago, that this world cannot give us what we really want, somehow there's someone or something inside of us that doesn't quite believe that. At a very deep level, we are conditioned to turn to whatever it is that we're looking at as a way to assuage our suffering, our pain, and to feel good, and to fill that perceived emptiness inside of us. So what is that that keeps us addicted? The word that the Buddha used was tanha, which is a Sanskrit and Pali word for, literally it means thirst. And it's the kind of thirst that if you're out in the desert for several days and haven't had water, it's that kind of thirst. That's what tanha refers to. It's that deep, deep craving. So, what is it that keeps us hooked? What is it that drives this tanha, this addiction? The Buddha recognized three causes. There's not really three separate causes, but there's really three facets of one cause. Makes me, I always think of this growing up Catholic, being told about the Trinity and what a mystery it is, and how there's not one, there's not three gods, there's one God, but somehow there's three people in that God. And I think of dukkha, the cause of dukkha, is much the same way, that there's three faces to it, but there's only one ultimate cause. The one face of dukkha, or the cause of dukkha, is craving. Craving, grasping, clinging. I think we all know what it is, regardless of what we call it. It's that tendency of the mind to want to possess, devour, cling to, appropriate for oneself. I gotta have it. I can't live without it. That's the words, those are the words inside that feeling of craving. And just remember the last time you were involved in craving, in whatever form it took. Just be aware of what that feeling is like. It's very powerful. It's very gripping. Very compelling. In fact, most of the time we're acting it out before we're even aware of the feeling itself. You know, we're already halfway through the bag of potato chips before we realize that we're addicted. And these cravings drive our behaviors. They structure many of our ways of relating with one another. Drives our thought patterns. And as I mentioned last night, we develop strategies then for getting these cravings satisfied. And then these strategies become part of our identity. At a very young age, we're conditioned to believe that if only I'm something enough, then I can get this craving met, this craving for love, or this craving for attention, or this craving for power, this craving for safety, this craving for security. If only I'm good enough, if only I'm smart enough, if only I'm pretty enough, if only I'm helpful enough, if only I'm tough enough. Whatever it is that seems to work, we become very identified with that strategy. And then that strategy is fed by the craving for whatever it is that we want or believe we need. And the paradox is, as children, we do need certain things from our parents and our family. As children, we can't simply decide that, well, I guess I'm going to stop craving love because I'm not getting any. It doesn't work that way. It's seemingly hardwired into the human condition. And so our strategies become identities. And then these identities become invisible to us because they're not something we're looking at, but rather something we're looking through. Our identity becomes like a pair of glasses. I don't see my glasses, I see through my glasses. And those glasses change what I see. If I'm wearing rose-colored glasses, it's going to look very different than if I'm wearing gray-colored glasses. And our identity, our hidden strategies, our sense of self, is very much like that. And most human beings don't even realize that's taking place. They simply believe that this is reality. My perception of it is the way it really is. It really is a rose-colored world or a purple-colored world or a gray-colored world or whatever it is. We don't have the thought that this is my interpretation based on my conditioning. We simply have the thought this is the way it is. Now, the problem with this is, there's several really, but one problem with this is we encounter other people that are wearing different glasses than we are. And so we may be living with or working for somebody that has a very different view of what reality is than we do. Now, if we realize what's taking place, we can still communicate with one another because we can say, hey, let's talk about how we can identify what glasses you're looking through, what lens you're looking through. And in understanding that, then I'll realize you're looking through a different lens than I am. Maybe we can even take off our glasses and communicate, possibly. There's a Rumi poem that says, There's a field out beyond right and wrong. I'll meet you there. You see, most of us don't live in that field. We live in the field of right and wrong. And of course, we're always on the side of right, and the other person's on the side of wrong. Seems how it's amazing the way that always works, isn't it? I've never encountered somebody saying, you know, my problem is I'm wrong and they're right. Doesn't seem to land that way, does it? So we see there's all sorts of problems that arise, not only from the strategy, but from the basic craving itself. And yet, paradoxically, there's not a whole lot we can do about the craving. It just seems to be there. It isn't something we call forth. It's there whether we want it to be there or not. So that's one of the causes of suffering, as the Buddha identified it, craving, grasping. A second one is similar to that, only it's just the obverse. It's craving inside out, often referred to as aversion. We might call it resistance. Craving is a grasping for, a holding on to. Aversion is a pushing away. Craving says, I can't live without that. Aversion says, I can't live with that. It's the same energy, only it's turned inside out, so to speak. It's a craving that something goes away. If I have a toothache, I'm craving that the toothache goes away. And I'm convinced that if that toothache goes away, I'll live happily ever after. And eventually the toothache goes away, and I am happy for 20 minutes or so. And then something else starts bothering me. And pretty soon I'm just as miserable as I was with the toothache, only it's something else that's aching. So even getting rid of stuff isn't satisfying. There's not enough stuff to have to be permanently happy, and there's not enough stuff to get rid of to be permanently happy. And this can get very subtle, because sometimes we come to the realization that, well, you know, the problem isn't with other people, the problem isn't with my spouse or my boss or my kids. The problem is definitely with me, I'll own that. So I'm going to go to psychotherapy, I'm going to figure out what the problem is and get rid of it. That'll take care of it. So we can do that, and that can be very helpful to do that. We may feel better, we may function better, may have better relationships. But ultimately, we're still not completely satisfied. Getting rid of my neuroses, maybe like fixing a flat tire. It's a good idea, but it's not enough, you see. So it's very helpful to be aware of this, I call it the if-only mind. If only I had this and this and this, and if only I could get rid of this and this and this. How many times a day does that go on? I don't know about you, but in my mind, hundreds. If only they served thus and so for lunch instead of what they really have. If only it was warmer in here or colder in here or something or in here. If only something was different. And again, I'm not saying that sometimes we don't need to make changes in our life. If you're cold, put on a coat. That's fine. But you're not going to be any happier with the coat on than you were with the coat off. So we're driven by this desire for, whether you call it happiness or satisfaction, fulfillment, whatever name you want to put on it. We all know what it is we want. And that's not bad. That's not bad at all, because that drive is telling us that we haven't found it in the places we've been looking. But the problem is we hook it on to conditions. The mind says, if only I was loved enough, or if only I could love enough, then I'd be happy. Or if only I had more intelligence or willpower or whatever. Similar to the if only mind is something I call the when then mind. When I get my degree, then I'll be happy. When I get married, then I'll be happy. When I get to the retreat, then I'll be happy. When the retreat's over, then I'll be happy. Can't wait to get to the retreat, and then after the two sittings, I can't wait for the bell to ring, you know? So the if-only mind, the when-then mind, just notice when that shows up. And I want to be clear that I'm not saying we should not change conditions or take action, because sometimes we need to. If we're hungry, obviously we need to eat. If we're in a bad relationship, it may be a good idea to get out of it. You see? So it's not about that we should passively accept whatever life gives us. It's not that we should somehow not be craving things. It's going to happen. We need to live in this world. But the important point is to be aware when we look for these changes to bring us a sense of happiness that we have attributed to the condition. The third cause, there's craving and aversion, first two causes. The third cause is sometimes referred to as delusion or ignorance. Delusion is a great word because delusion refers to believing something to be true that's not true. It means buying into an illusion. And so craving tells us if we get enough of something or the right something, we'll be happy. Aversion tells us if we get rid of the right thing, or the wrong thing, as the case may be, that we'll be happy. If it wasn't for him, if it wasn't for her, if only this were different. Delusion is when we believe that. There's a psychological principle called projection, which basically says when we're unaware of something within us, that which we are refusing to see within us, we're going to see outside of ourselves. You know, the person that refuses to look at their own anger or hostility is going to bump into all sorts of angry and hostile people out there. Well, it's basically that same principle, that when we don't see the cause of our suffering within ourselves, then we project that cause as being external to us. Then we project that cause onto the conditions in our life, our environment, other people, places, or things. That's delusion. Delusion is what keeps us locked into the cycle of craving and aversion. And according to the Buddhist theory, delusion is what drives what's called samsara, which is this endless cycle of seeking and not finding, lifetime after lifetime. It's interesting, there's also a perfume named samsara. I'm sure there's a connection there somehow, but... Yeah, samsara is sort of the endless craving, the endless search for satisfaction in the world of form or the world of the thoughts or emotions. And the apparent dilemma with all of this is that if we try to get out of it, that's just more craving, right? If I resist it, that's just more resistance. If I crave to get rid of my craving, then I'm just throwing gasoline on top of the fire. If I resist my resistance, I'm just perpetuating the suffering. So the paradox is, in the Buddhist awareness, is that awareness itself, when we see, that's why this is called insight meditation. Vipassana means deep insight into the nature of reality. When we see deeply and clearly and directly, not with the thinking mind, and not even psychologically with the emotions, but with a deep knowing of how this mechanism works, then we're free. And the way we do that is by paying attention. By paying attention to our dukkha. And rather than avoiding it, either by trying to act it out, or by trying to numb it out, or by denying it, we look right at it. In fact, we welcome it, kind of like Rumi was saying. The malice, the shame. We welcome it, not in a masochistic sense, but we welcome it in the sense that this is an opportunity to look at dissatisfaction and to understand its nature and its causes and to be a little more free from it. And so when we sit and our back hurts, the delusional mind will say, well, I need a better bench. I need a chiropractic adjustment. I need a massage. I need to quit doing this meditation practice. If only this pain would go away, then I'd be happy forever. So we watch everything that the mind brings to our experiences of discomfort. If only I had a better this or a better that. Or a different this, or a different that. Maybe I need to find a different teacher. That's it. Maybe I need to go to India. That's what I'm going to do. So the mind will look for all sorts of things to avoid this experience of dukkha. And in this practice, we don't run away from it. We just look at it. We see it for what it is. We notice pain. We notice the resistance to pain. We see that those are two different things. It's possible to experience pain without resistance. And when that happens, pain is just pain. It's not suffering. It's possible to experience pleasure without addiction. Pleasure is just pleasure. I don't suffer when it goes away. We deliberately create an environment where we close all the escape hatches. We don't have a television in here that I'm aware of. We close down the bar. There's not an entertainment center here. There's not too many escape hatches, you say. We do that deliberately, because in the world there's tons of them. And we do that so that we can look directly at what's going on and begin to gain some insight from that. And that insight is what liberates us. It may happen suddenly. More often than not, though, it happens very gradually, very slowly. We may go to a retreat and not even be aware of anything happening. But a few weeks later, we may notice that we're living a little bit differently. We're not quite as stressed out. Our buttons don't get pushed quite as often. That's the nature of insight. It works much of the time below the level of the conscious mind. So this is kind of like a laboratory. We take our little sufferings. I say little because most of our suffering at retreat is, you know, aching back, too hot, too cold, boredom, sadness, something like that. We take our little sufferings and we look at them. It's a little bit like putting something in a test tube. Maybe in our everyday life, we don't have the opportunity to do that. We're too busy raising a family, earning a living, whatever. We're preoccupied. But here, we can look at each moment. And so it's very important to relish each moment, even the difficult ones. And I might even add, with the risk of sounding sadistic, even relish the difficult ones, because those are the opportunities to gain a bit more freedom. And the beautiful thing is that there's nothing we really need to do other than be aware, be present. The power of simple awareness is incredible. We don't have to resort to a strategy that says, well, I'm smart enough to figure this out, or I'm tough enough to handle this, or whatever our particular strategy might be. We don't need to resort to that. We don't need to be victimized by our difficulties. We don't need to go to war with them. All we need to do is look them right in the eye. Just like the Buddha did 2,500 years ago when he was confronted by the armies of Mara, as the legend goes. He just looked Mara right in the eye. Said, I see you. And in that moment, Mara disappeared because he no longer had the power of delusion. The antidote to delusion is awareness, is knowing.